This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Terrell Alvin McCraney's resume is like a playwright's dream. He got his MFA from Yale. He apprenticed under August Wilson. He's a member of the Steppenwolf Theater Company. He's been in residence at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and last year he won a MacArthur Genius Grant, all before he turned 33. And now McCraney, who people talk about becoming the greatest playwright of his generation, turns his attention to the greatest of all time. McCraney is the editor and director of a new production of Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra, which is playing now at the Public Theater in New York. Terrell McCraney, welcome to Studio 360.
And thank you so much for having me.
So, Mark Antony and Cleopatra lived in Rome and Egypt 2 millennia ago. You set your version in French colonial Haiti 2 centuries ago. Explain yourself.
Explain myself. Well, the play was a commission from the Royal Shakespeare Company and the Public Theater here in New York. And the idea was to create a version of the play that could be played with 10 actors, but also would allow it to be what it was designed to be, a history and a tragedy. And I wanted to place it somewhere that the history felt alive and visceral, something that people didn't have to run to their phones and Google the understandings or the relationships between Pompey and Octavius, but understand the colonial relationship between the two nations. And so for me, I wanted to place it somewhere that we could see it and feel it, and it could be alive in the room and sort of instantaneous in a way.
I mean, it's one thing to say Midsummer Night's Dream wherever, whenever, but when you're dealing with historical figures, that must be trickier.
It can be. I mean, we also know of a very incredible production of Richard III that was done in Nazi Germany. I mean, the great thing about history, sometimes the most tragic thing about history, is that it repeats itself. And we recognize that we see these patterns in human behavior over and over again. And so putting a history in another portion of history only highlights that that history is still being made.
Actually, that brings up my favorite quote ever attributed to Mark Twain, which is that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Mm. And I guess this it definitely does that.
Yes. Well, we try.
I want to play a scene from this current Royal Shakespeare Company production that's playing in New York. We are going to hear Act 5, Scene 2, if you can set it up for us.
Cleopatra is surrounded by soldiers, and she has been taken, basically, prisoner. And Mark Antony is given the ghost, and now she's fighting for her own freedom.
I dreamed there was an Emperor Antony. His face was as the heavens, and therein stuck a sun and moon, which kept their course and lighted the little old earth.
Most sovereign creature.
His legs bestrid the ocean. His reared arm crested the world. His voice was propertied as all the tunid spheres, and that to friends. But when he meant to quail and shake the orb, he was as rattling thunder.
Cleopatra.
Think you there was, or might be, such a man as this I dreamed of?
Gentle madam, no.
You lie up to the hearing of the gods.
That was Gioacchino Colucango and Henry Stram in Antony and Cleopatra, edited and directed by Terrell Alvin McCraney, who is here with me. So what does it mean exactly to edit Shakespeare?
Well, I think most Shakespeare is edited these days.
Although you're billed, which is unusual, as the editor.
Right, because I did a lot of editing.
You reordered things.
Necessarily, yeah, because we definitely had 10 actors instead of the 44 or at least 17 to do the play with.
Yeah, you had a lot of people playing three roles, which is unusual.
Yes, definitely. What I think was interesting about the project is that we wanted it to be movable. A movable feast that we could take from the UK to Miami and reside then here in New York City, which
right.
We've done. And it's difficult to take a company of 44 or even 17, and we had to go with a number that we thought we could sustain for those 3 playing stations.
You had barely gotten your master's from Yale in 2007 when theaters around America and England started producing the brother-sister plays, your trilogy of plays, which is set in the Louisiana Bayou. With some characters that go from play to play and lots of common themes. But they are 3 very distinct plays. If you could describe them, if I meet you on a plane and I say, what do you do? And you, oh, I'm a playwright. Oh, what are your plays?
Well, first of all, I'd never say that. If you said, what do you do? I would go, oh, I'm an artist.
But then I would say, oh, what's your art like? Anyhow, how would you describe these three plays in a couple of sentences?
I would describe them as an opportunity to look into working class African-American lives.
I want to play a scene from the last play in the trilogy, which is called Marcus or the Secret of Sweet. And this is a story of a young man coming of age and coming out as well.
Enter the boys.
In this class of language, there are boys from all the teams. Focus.
They sit behind Marcus.
From basketball to track, varsity to junior.
Whispering.
Marcus. And every Monday, Marcus, while the pop quiz is lined the desks.
Hey, Marcus.
The boys all leaning a little closer. Marcus. Trying to pick up the answers that Mark is slinging down.
Marcus Eschew.
They make propositions.
Hey.
Whisper in hush, teacher can't hear tones.
Let me see.
The heads yanking, their mouths smile.
Mark.
Motioning for me to move my head.
Move your hand. Move.
Whispering.
Marcus. Marcus.
Focus.
But see, all they want are the answers to the test.
Focus.
Answers that will make it easier to get back to track and field.
Focus.
But Marcus's mind is wishing that their heads were yanking and their mouths were asking.
Focus, Marcus.
So let me come over.
Focus.
Let me step closer.
Focus.
Let me.
That was from the MacArthur Theater production of Marcus or the Secret of Sweet.
I like that scene.
It's a great scene.
Oh, thanks. I didn't remember I liked it so much.
Well, there you go. It gives the listener a sense of a thing you do a lot in these plays, which is have the characters narrate their actions before they do them as though they're reading stage directions. How did you and why did you develop that device?
Well, the plays all feel like and deal with theater in a way that has much more of a storytelling element to it. And I wanted to keep that element as alive as possible. These stories came to me in a storytelling mode, and I thought that they would be best experienced that way. So you felt an instant connection with the actors because they weren't anywhere but in the room with you, explaining to you or telling you or guiding you through these very complicated lives.
So tell me about this trilogy. You're from Miami. What inspired you to set these stories, these plays, in rural Louisiana?
I've been spending more time not just in Louisiana, but sort of in the bayou and in the sort of backwoods of Alabama and Georgia and Florida.
Why?
Because that's where most of my family's from.
Uh-huh.
And also because it's just beautiful country to visit. It's a part of the country that we rarely see or hear of until it's being, you know, drowned by hurricanes or floods or something. And it was compelling me to talk about the stories and ghosts and things that I was hearing about, learning about then. But it was also interesting to me that especially in the Red and Brown Water comes from
which is the title of the first play in the trilogy.
That swamp Everglades look that looks like brown water that you could probably stand on. And you probably could on certain places, but then all of a sudden that water drops down to about 15 feet and how treacherous that life could be. Living in places where you thought you were on dry land, when in a second you aren't anymore.
And speaking of writing about what you know, the character Marcus from the scene we heard a little earlier is this young man who's discovering that he's gay. How autobiographical is this?
Not at all.
Really?
I mean, other than I'm gay and black. I wish my coming out experience were like Marcus's. Marcus is also, I mean, the main secret of his suite is that he has a connection to another world and that he ushers in these dreams that somehow seem prophetic, and he's trying to find his way or his place in his community.
Really? And you don't think of your playwriting as some more worldly version of that kind of prophetic impulse?
No. No, I don't think my plays are snatched down from some sort of...
I'm not saying place. Literally.
Oh. Yeah. See? But that's the problem. But I think literally Marcus is spiritually connected to his community,
right,
in the way, and he's trying to figure it out. I have written things that are autobiographical. They just are boring. So I never make them plays.
Whether or not your life makes for great theater, it would make for a great biopic because you had this really rough life. Your mother was an addict and died when you were young and she was young.
Sure. I mean, my mother died when I was my last year at DePaul. But she was sick for a long time, and that was pretty hard on the whole family. And I lived with my dad when I was in high school, and that was pretty rough, because my dad wasn't necessarily as excited about the arts as everybody else was. But I don't
think— Because he just thought it was a waste of your time, or—
Well, when you grow up poor, you sort of hope that your kid will grow up and be a lawyer or a doctor. And knowing what we know about society, if they live past 25, you just hope they have some skill to sort of make their life a little easier. And I think he was worried about that. He also could tell that I was gay or at least gay identifying at some point. And he was worried about that as well, which is, you know, understandable in the neighborhood and environment we grew up in.
He must be pleased with your success.
He's pleased and surprised, as we all are, I think.
Was there some point at which you, in addition to saying, oh, I can do this the rest of my life, where you realized I can really shoot for the heights and the brass ring and I can go to Yale and I can be a producer of the public and all that?
I said a very simple prayer one night, which was, if you allow me to continue to work hard, meaning not starve to death, I will continue to work hard. And so I do continue to work hard.
So you've been working on this Antony and Cleopatra for a while now. I mean, is it okay, directing, this is great, fine, but I want to get back in my room and write some plays?
I want to get back in my room and sleep. You think that's funny, but I'm dead serious. I want to go to sleep. So I want to go home at night and not, you know, rattle over lines and sort of go, oh, yes, that line, yes, that lighting time, that water cue, that, you know, it's sort of, you know, one of those moments.
So I can imagine.
Yeah, so.
Well, good luck and get some sleep.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Terrell Alvin McCraney's take on Antony and Cleopatra is at the Public Theater in New York City through the end of March.